This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, at his first news conference since being selected as India's next prime minister, Manmohan Singh vowed to increase the living standards of India's poor, to continue the policy of economic reform, and to work toward peace with arch-rival Pakistan. The prime minister-designate appeared to go out of his way to be non-controversial in an effort to reassure India's markets, business, and foreign investors, as well as the Congress party faithful. All have been in an uproar since Sonia Gandhi led Congress to a surprise electoral victory and then turned down the job of prime minister. We'll talk about what happened and why, and how the new government's policies may affect the robust economy of recent years. We'll also ask how the new prime minister will deal with what could be a fractious coalition and with the considerable figure of Sonia Gandhi, who will stay on as head of the Congress party. Later in the program, DidTheyReadIt.com, a new service that promises to secretly track an email so you know when it gets read, how long it stays open, and whether it gets forwarded. But first, India. If you have questions about the political and economic challenges facing India's new prime minister, give us a call. If you do business there or have a family connection, we want to hear what you think of this month's unexpected political turn. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now from New Delhi is John Lancaster, South Asia Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. John, thanks for staying up so late to talk with us.
Not at all. You're welcome.
The Prime Minister-designate, Mr. Singh, used his news conference today to lay out a vision of sorts for India. What did he have to say?
Well, he really hit on three main points, two of them domestic and one relating to foreign policy. On the domestic side, he talked about economic reforms, and he reiterated the message that he's been delivering for the last several days, which is essentially to reassure investors and financial markets that there will not be a reversal of economic reforms, although there's clearly going to be a change of emphasis. The Congress party feels that the previous government neglected the needs of the poor in liberalizing its economy, and they aim to remedy that, although it's not quite clear how at this point. He talked about communalism and communal violence in India and the government's desire to make sure that tensions between Hindus and Muslims did not flare up into violence as they did in 2002 in the state of Gujarat. And he also, to some extent, blamed the outgoing government for fostering the atmosphere that led to that violence, although he tried to avoid being too explicit about that. And then finally, he talked about the India-Pakistan peace process and his desire to make sure that that stayed on track. He talked about how if the Berlin Wall could come down, there was no reason why India and Pakistan couldn't live peacefully.
Dealing with that last point first, how has Pakistan reacted to the surprise result that removed its negotiating partner and to the elevation of Mr. Singh?
I think they're sort of in a wait-and-see mode. I mean, the Pakistanis clearly were very comfortable, as comfortable as a Pakistani government can be, I should say, with the outgoing Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee. He was someone who was widely respected and to some degree trusted in Pakistan. So there's obviously some apprehension on that side of the border about whether the new prime minister is going to have, you know, sufficient stature and commitment to carry that momentum forward. In their public statements, they've been quite cautious. They've been supportive and welcoming of the new government, and they certainly welcomed the prime minister-designate's remarks today.
Now, explain to us, you've had a few days to parse out what happened on election day there. You have an economy that has been booming in recent years after a stare down with Pakistan. Peace talks are underway. Peace and prosperity. Why did the government lose? And more important, why did Congress sweep to victory?
Well, I think you know, the economy has been booming, but it hasn't been booming for all. It's been booming in urban centers. It's been booming for people involved in you know, the high tech and outsourcing industries. But that's really a pretty small percentage of the Indian electorate. And I think you know, to the extent that there is more prosperity in India, it's a somewhat superficial phenomenon, and it's largely confined to the cities. The rural areas are still suffering, you know, a lack of basic health care and infrastructure. And I think the previous government's campaign slogan of India Shining really kind of backfired, because, you know, for an awful lot of Indians who don't live in the cities and who don't have college degrees and can't get jobs in call centers, for example, you know, India really isn't shining. And Sonia Gandhi, the Congress Party leader, really picked up on that, and her message played very well in India, much better than anyone expected.
And I guess that's the next question. What happened? Sonia Gandhi led the party to its surprise victory. And then has anybody figured out why she decided not to accept the post of prime minister?
Well, you know, there are certainly a lot of competing theories. I suppose one place to start is with just with what she said, which is that she never really wanted to be prime minister, and that, you know, her goal was always to sort of reestablish the primacy of the Congress Party and the secular values that it represents. And that having done that, she now, you know, she felt no need to move into that job. Now, there are a number of other factors at work here. I mean, because she was born in Italy, she had been the focus of very active and growing protests by Hindu nationalists who felt that it was inappropriate for a foreign-born woman to lead this country. And, you know, I think that probably influenced her decision as well. I don't think there's much doubt that had she taken the prime minister's job, the opposition led by the outgoing the BJP party would have made a continuing issue out of her foreign origin, and it could have hampered her effectiveness. But I also think one has to, you know, listen to what she actually said, and I think it's perhaps possible that maybe, you know, she wasn't really in this to become prime minister.
Well, so instead of India's first foreign-born prime minister, India will now have its first non-Hindu prime minister. Mr. Singh is a Sikh.
That's right. That is a first, as you said. And I think, you know, that it's really kind of a remarkable turn of events where you had this Hindu nationalist government, which just lost the elections. And now not only will you have a Sikh as prime minister, but you have a Muslim as a president. So this is really sort of an affirmation of the kind of secular values that the Congress Party has long, you know, said that it stands for.
Sonia Gandhi will stay on as the leader of the Congress Party, and some are saying that she now has all the power with none of the accountability.
Well, I don't know if she has all the power. I mean, certainly she's going to remain a very powerful figure, but I think, you know, in terms of the Indian Constitution, I mean, the prime minister is clearly the top job in India. And, you know, while I'm sure Dr. Singh, the incoming prime minister, is going to consult and work with her very closely, she's not going to be the prime minister. She will be the head of the Congress Party in Parliament, and obviously will retain a lot of power. But I think her, you know, I think a lot of what motivates her is sort of is maintaining the Nehru-Gandhi legacy and making sure that the Congress Party sort of stays on track and stays in power. But I don't think it's quite the same thing as saying that she's actually going to be running the country from behind the scenes, although, of course, we won't really know until the new government takes shape.
And the new government should take shape and the prime minister be sworn in when? Over the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, the word today was that the swearing in would probably be on Saturday, although it's still a little bit fluid because there's an awful lot of cabinet positions to fill, and you know, it's just a sort of a question as to whether he can match the names to the jobs in time to form a government by the weekend. But certainly within the next few days, he should be sworn in.
John Lancaster, thanks very much for staying up to talk with us.
Not at all. You're welcome.
John Lancaster is the Washington Post South Asia bureau chief, and he spoke with us from his home in New Delhi. Well, joining us now from our bureau in Chicago is Shumeet Ganguly, the director of the India Studies Program and professor of political science at Indiana University in Bloomington. And welcome to Talk of the Nation. Nice to have you back.
It's good to be back.
Is it fair to say that Sonia Gandhi and her Congress party really didn't expect to win?
They certainly did not expect to win. They did think that they would do better. The early exit polls indicated that the BJP was not doing especially well. But this was a serendipitous outcome.
And as for the new prime minister, I mean, one of the big questions as to being the continuation of economic reforms. He is credited with starting those economic reforms when he was a finance minister back in the last Congress government, 14 years ago?
This is exactly right. India was faced with an unprecedented financial crisis in 1991, and Manmohan Singh at that point was the finance minister. He could have tided over this particular financial crisis by making some very modest ameliorative reforms and then gone back to business as usual. But then pursuing that kind of a strategy would simply kick the problem down the road, and once again, India yawning deficits, both a domestic deficit and also a foreign deficit, would come back to haunt the country. And instead of simply kicking the problem down the road, he and a aging Prime Minister, Narasimha Rao, managed to cobble together a consensus on reform and proceeded with considerable dexterity to basically shift the entire course of Indian economic strategy.
Our telephone number, by the way, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Jayant, who's in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
Yes, hi. I have a question to the experts. Do you see any indication that the life of average Indian in terms of clothing, food and shelter would really change despite the governments have come and gone?
I think they already have changed, and I think Marshall should also weigh in on this because he knows more about economics than I do.
In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Marshall Bouton, but go ahead.
Well, certainly, while there is a ongoing debate amongst economists about the extent to which poverty has been alleviated since the reforms were undertaken in 1991, there is a clear-cut evidence that there is there has been a drop in the overall rates of poverty in India. Then once one disaggregates the statistics, there is indeed an urban-rural divide. Certain states have prospered considerably. There are a certain set of states in northern India, particularly Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, Madhya Pradesh, and Rajasthan. These have not done exceedingly well. But certainly the western part of India, significant portions of the south and even portions of the east have done very well under this reform process. So, yes, the life of the average Indian has improved since independence in 1947 and more dramatically since 1991. The evidence is unequivocally in favor of the reforms, even though portions of the country have not seen the benefits of reform.
And I guess on Jayant's behalf, I'll have to raise the question, if that's the case, why did so many of those people in the rural areas decide to throw out the party that was leading the reforms, the BJP, and vote for Congress, which ran on the manifesto of improving their lives? And I'll have to ask you to answer the question when we come back from a break. Jayant, thank you very much for the phone call. And we'll continue this conversation about India after a short break. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Back shortly. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the recent political changes in India and what they may mean for economic reform and peace initiatives with Pakistan. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email address is totn@npr.org. With us is Shumit Ganguly, the Director of India Studies Program and Professor of Political Science at Indiana University. Before the break, I asked if, as you say, the lot of average Indians has improved under reform since 1991. Why was the rural-based power of Congress rising up and throwing out the what they regarded as, John Lancaster told us, most of the prosperity had gone to the cities?
Well, it was not simply a rural revolt. There were other factors that also led to the debacle for the BJP. So one has to look at a multiplicity of factors to explain the outcome of the election. But to the extent that rural voters rebelled against the BJP, it was because not everyone, as I conceded at the very outset, were the beneficiaries of reform. Obviously, the reform process is uneven. Certain states have been the beneficiaries. Certain states have not. And so it's not surprising that some voters did feel disaffected.
Well, joining us now is Marshall Bouton, the president of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, a specialist on South Asian politics and economies. And it's good to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
He's also there in our bureau in Chicago. And one of the things, I know you're acquainted with the new prime minister personally.
I am.
And as he looks ahead towards, he says he's going to continue the policy of economic reform, will he be slowing down the pace of economic reform?
In certain areas he will, and in other areas he won't. I think the new government is certainly in favor of continuing the inward flows of investment, both direct investment and portfolio investment, that have boosted India's foreign exchange reserves so radically and dramatically in the last several years. They're certainly in favor of the continuation of the IT revolution in India. They will certainly continue to foster the growth of the urban middle class. That's all to the good. Where the slowdown will come is in particularly in the area of privatizing public sector enterprises. In fact, the Prime Minister has already said they are going to stop or at least slow down for the time being privatization, which was a major initiative of the BJP.
Yet, and what is he specifically going to do in terms of, helping to improve, raise the standards of living in India's mm-hmm. countryside?
Well, let me first say, going back to the previous exchange, that I think we are a little bit at risk. And when I say we, I'm talking about everybody, the media and other commentators, of overinterpreting the message of a rural voter revolt against the BJP and favoring the Congress. In fact, one of the perhaps an even more important factor in this result was what those of us who follow this talk call anti-incumbency. That is, the tendency of the Indian voter, it's a very pronounced tendency to kind of throw the bums out no matter who they are with great regularity. Now, that's not just a sort of perverse behavior. That's a behavior of the Indian voter saying, we don't think anybody is governing us very effectively. And so that when you follow this around, it comes to the same thing, and that is that many Indian voters, especially in the countryside, are not happy with their lot. Now, I don't think the new government has many tools at its disposal to change the standards of living for the rural Indian very quickly. Among other things, it's constrained by a still very large fiscal deficit, roughly 10% of GDP. It's going to be hard to put capital in that takes years to make a difference that way. What they're going to focus on first is public works and, more unfortunately, providing subsidies of various kinds to the rural sector, in particular to farmers, and this has already begun to happen in the state of Andhra Pradesh, where they're offering now free power to farmers.
Isn't free power, some critics have said, this is likely to undermine the sane or the more sensible fiscal policies of recent years?
Absolutely. And it will also at least slow, if not ultimately stop, what has finally been a turnaround in the power sector in India, which has been resistant to change for 15 years. That is a real risk. So they'll attempt to moderate that, but the populist pressures on this government are going to be very strong, and they're going to want to try to do something quickly, and those are the tools at their disposal.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Jim, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, hi. I was in India about 8 weeks ago, specifically Bangalore, and one of the things I noticed, it was kind of interesting, there was a really big disconnect between the people in the city and the people in the countryside. I watched a lot of news while I was there, talked to a lot of people on the street, read a lot of the newspapers, and I don't remember anyone predicting that the BJP would lose. It was taken as pretty much self-evident, which I found kind of interesting. I also have three questions for your guests.
Well, let me ask you first, Jim. What do you mean by the disconnect between the city and the countryside?
Well, like I say, everyone in the city, you got the attitude, the feeling when you're in the city, you know, everything was great. It has a feel of, I don't know, like India was going to become one of the next Asian tigers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the economy, things were just going up and up.
Bangalore, the center of the technology industry.
Technology and a lot of aerospace in Bangalore. But you go out into the countryside, rural areas, and you felt like you'd step back at least 50 years. Just extreme poverty.
Anyway, your question.
Yeah, my questions. Three questions. There was talk about 6 months ago, I remember reading on the BBC, of a huge waterworks project that was going to be about $100 billion U.S. I was wondering how that was going.
Why don't we do them one at a time? Shumit Ganguly, yeah. Can you help us out on that?
Sure. This is a very imaginative and some people might say harebrained scheme for diverting rivers in India, because there are certain parts of India which are chronically short of water, where farmers suffer droughts on a routine basis. And the government had conceived, the BJP government had conceived of this plan to divert rivers in a fairly dramatic sort of fashion. And the scientific evidence on this is somewhat mixed about whether or not this could be accomplished. And obviously, there are significant ecological consequences which are very difficult to anticipate. Consequently, this was a scheme that had drawn some fire, and it's still in a very incipient stage. And I doubt that the present government is going to address it with any degree of vigor, because I think there are going to be other more compelling issues facing them in the near future rather than this enormous infrastructural project.
Go ahead. Your second question, Jim?
Yeah, my second question is, after September 11th, it seemed like there was going to be kind of a strategic alliance between the U.S., India, and Israel. And my understanding is the Congress Party has made it quite clear that the alignment with Israel won't happen. I was just curious what was going on with that.
Marshall Bouton, why don't you tackle that?
Well, the BJP government did, for the first time since Indian independence, establish normal relations with Israel, and Prime Minister Sharon visited India several months back, and there's been an extraordinary expansion of the relationship between India and Israel. The Congress Party, I think, will approach that relationship with some greater caution, or if not skepticism. I doubt they're going to walk back up the road and break relations with Israel. There's already developed a very important defense supply relationship between India and Israel, which the government of India will not want to do away with.
Let me just follow up. Do you expect that India's military, which has been expanding, and certainly in naval and air force as well, that expansion will continue?
Well, they're going to be, yes, I do, is the short answer. There may be some fluctuations in the levels of expansion. The BJP had a very strong foreign policy, a very outward-looking policy. I suspect the Congress government will be somewhat more restrained in its approach to India's developing of a modern military force, but I think the longer-term trends will be the same.
Okay, and finally, Jim?
Okay, yeah, my last question. Mr. Singh, who looks like is going to become prime minister, I was just curious, was he the fellow who was responsible for a lot of the economic reforms in the early 90s, strengthening of the currency reserves, etc.
Yeah, Shamit Ganguly answered that question earlier. Yes, he was. So
okay.
We'll keep it short and move on to the next question.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Jim.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go now and get a question from Jay, and Jay is with us in Salt Lake City.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
I lived in India for 2 years, mostly in rural areas, also in big cities, too. But basically, I saw the biggest problem when you were talking about economic reforms not reaching everybody was the caste system. And the caste system pretty much owns India's villages. I was wondering if you think the new Congress government is going to do anything about alleviating the problems of the caste system in the villages.
Shamit Ganguly?
Well, actually, the caste system is breaking down. And in fact, India has witnessed the most dramatic mobilization of caste, particularly in northern India, in the last couple of decades. What is happening in northern India currently and has happened over the last several decades is a process that took place earlier in southern India, where lower castes and people who were at the margins of society are now increasingly asserting themselves. They are voting with their feet. There are a number of caste-based parties. So the stranglehold of caste, which had held people back for generations together, is finally under assault. We are witnessing what I would consider to be a virtual social revolution within our lifetimes.
I guess I just didn't see that, you know, when I was there. I didn't see people, you know, the poverty is so rampant among lower caste people. I mean, I just didn't see the reforms actually taking place. It seemed to be more of a, you know, that's what politicians would say rather than that's what's being done.
Well, you cannot alleviate the poverty of several hundred years in the matter of a couple of decades. But I do believe that there is dramatic mobilization. Today, you have a number of people who belong to lower castes in significant positions in parliament. These are, of course, not always the most exemplary representatives of their particular castes. But the mere fact that the social composition of the Indian parliament is changing, India's massive affirmative action program has benefited significant numbers of people from lower castes. And in fact, there are growing demands for the expansion of these programs. And this is obviously encountering a degree of resistance from people who have wielded both political and economic power. So these things in a democracy cannot be done overnight. These things take an extraordinary amount of time. Witness the fact that civil rights in this country, we are just this year celebrating the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education in this country. And if one looks at elite newspapers like the New York Times, they have been running articles on how much progress has been made, but also how in many areas progress has not been made. And inequality still persists in this country. So it's not surprising to me that inequality and poverty in India still stalk the land.
Thanks for the call, Jay. Go ahead.
I just had a word on that. I think the question points to an observation that one might make at this point, and that is that India needs both growth and better distribution. India spent three decades hardly growing at all economically, and you at the end of the day, when you have a sustained, prolonged period of no growth, there's not much to distribute. But you also need better distribution of growth. And I think it's true that much of the growth has been concentrated in the cities and in the upper middle class, and that needs to change. But this government has to embrace both goals, high rates of growth and greater distribution of growth in the rural sector.
That's Marshall Bouton of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. We're also speaking with Shamit Ganguly of the Indiana University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Marshall Bouton, you know Mr. Singh. He is described as being not a great politician, great economist, great finance minister when he was that, but not greatly adept at being a politician. How is he going to deal with an office fractious coalition on his side? And are his greatest problems going to be coming from the leftists who supported Congress to make the government majority or from the opposition?
I think in the initial stages, in fact, there will be a considerable difficulty in pulling together a cohesive and effective government. I mean, let's remember first that the Congress has not been in power for 9 years. Secondly, this is a government that doesn't, this is a party that doesn't have a lot of, a deep bench of talent to fill key positions. There is the fact that power, in fact, is divided between the prime ministership and the, despite what the Washington Post correspondent said, and the president of the party is going to be a problem from time to time, and they're the communists who are going to be outside the government. So I think we're in for a lengthy period of some uncertainty and hopefully not turmoil, but instability as the government tries to get control and get a program that it can stand behind.
We have an email question from Vasudha Ganesan, an Indian now living in Denver, Colorado. Given that there's so much hype and news coverage about India's IT and outsourcing and the shift of white-collar job, my question really is, how big a slice of the economy is IT, information technology, and outsourcing, and are there other industries in which India is showing promise? And Shumit, do you want to tackle that?
The exact figure eludes me. I just saw the figure the other day, but unfortunately, I can't rattle off a figure off the top of my head in terms of what slice of the Indian economy IT now constitutes. But there are other areas which are all where India is also doing extremely well. One of them is in the realm of pharmaceuticals. Indian pharmaceutical companies are no longer simply in the business of replicating drugs, but are actually now starting to invest in research and development. And so we're going to see a much more robust pharmaceutical sector. Even certain segments of manufacturing are doing quite well. A venerable Indian conglomerate, Tata, has managed to completely revamp one of its cars, the Tata Indica, which is now actually being sold in France. These are some success stories that one doesn't hear about.
And obviously, the IT sector is doing very well.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Go ahead, Mark.
It's 1% of GDP.
1% of GDP, which is a considerable growth indeed. Marshall Bouton, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Marshall Bouton is former executive vice president of the Asia Society, now president of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. He was with us from our bureau in Chicago. And Shumit Ganguly, thank you.
My pleasure.
Mr. Ganguly is director of the India Studies Program and professor of political science at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And he joined us, as did Marshall Bouton from our bureau in Chicago. When we come back from a short break, we're going to be talking about new software that secretly tracks the emails you've sent. If you'd like to join us on this conversation, our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-8255 or 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. We promise not to track it secretly or openly. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.